Tonight is February the 11th. We continue with Yechezkel. We are in Perek Chav Zayin, chapter 27. And we were right in the middle when we stopped last time. I believe we were up to Pasuk Yud Gimel 13. I remember saying Greece, right? That's where up to Yavon. Okay. This is a... we're in the middle of a description, as Yechezkel is saying, a keen lamentation for Tsar. We are in the middle of a description of what was in Tsar before the destruction of Tsar. And so it's talking about how all the different nations would come to Tsar for trade. And Tsar became very, very wealthy because of that. And it's describing what each nation brought to Tsar. That's part of the kingdom. It's going to go on for a while. We were reading it quickly last time. We're going to continue reading quickly until we finish the description of what they would each bring, and then we will see some more details. So starting with Yud Gimel 13, Yavan Tuval Vameshech, three different countries including Greece, Hema Rochloich, they are your merchants, Benefesh Adam, what do they bring to sell or to Tsar? They would bring Nefesh Adam. Nefesh Adam are slaves, right? The slave trade. Uchlein Achoshes, and utensils made of copper. Nastu Ma'aravech, they would give as your merchandise. Yudalat 14, mi base Togarma, from base Togarma, wherever that is, they would bring Susim, Ufarashim, Ufiradim, horses and chariots, and mules. Nastu Izvonayach, they would give, another word for merchandise. B'nei Didan Rochlayach, the children of Didan. Didan was also a place. Rochlayach, again, from the word Rocha, which means merchants. Iyim Rabim, many islands. Sechoras Yodeich, they would do business with you. Yodeich means your hand, but it really here means your place. Karnos Shein V'Havinim, Heshivu Eshkarech, they would bring horns of Shein. Shein is ivory. And Havinim is another word for that sort of thing. Rashi says it was horns of gazelles and bones of elephants and types of big birds. They would bring, and Eshkarech again means as wares that they would bring you for trade. Aram sochartech merov ma'asayich. Aram, they would do business with you because of all they saw with you, and this is jewels. They saw you wearing jewelry, lots of precious stones. So that's what they would do business with. Benofech, I jumped the gun. That's coming up later. This is going to be not precious stones, but rather, precious stones. Sorry. Benofech, argaman, verikma, uvutz, veramos, vechadkod, all different types of precious stones, different colors. Nasnu bizvonayach, they gave as merchandise. Now, what about the Jews? What about Eretz Yisrael? Yehuda of Eretz Yisrael, hema rochloich, they did business with you. Bechite minis. Chite minis, Rashi struggles with what those words mean, but he ends up saying, chite comes from the word chitim, which means wheat, and minis, he says, was a particularly large type of wheat. It was a particularly full, large wheat that obviously was very good and produced a lot of bread. Ufanag udvash vashemen vatsori nasnu ma'aravech. And also, fanag is a farsmon. A farsmon is a spice. What is it? A farsmon?
It says balsam oil.
Balsam oil, excuse me. Balsam oil. I thought it was. Okay, balsam oil. Yeah, okay. No, I think that's right. A farsmon. And honey, and another type of oil. And tzori, which is another type of a spice, they gave as merchandise for you. Damasek, that's Damascus. Sochartech, they did business with you. Merov ma'asayach, with all of your doings, all of your dealings. Merov kolhon, from all of the wealth. Biyein chalbon, with white wine. Vitzemer tzachar, And wool, sachar, now tamar sachar, Chazal said, Rashi brings it, was a special type of wool. When the sheep was born, when the kid is born, they take the kid and immediately, right after the mother cleans the child, the mother would lick the child clean after being born, then they would immediately take that kid and wrap the kid in something to protect its wool. And then it would grow with this wrapping around it. I imagine it wasn't so tight. It gave room to grow. And it only covered the body part, the wool part, not the feet and hands, you know, not the face. And as it would grow, the wool would stay completely clean. See, when you shear a sheep, the wool is filthy. It's an animal, so it's all over the place. So, you know, the wool is filthy and it has to be cleaned. But here, this wool was kept perfectly clean from birth. And that's a special wool, very expensive, and it's called Tzemer Tzachar. V'don v'yavon mi'uzol b'izvonayech nasanu. And Don, now this does not mean Shevet Don. Apparently it was another place called Don. And Yavon in Greece. Mi'uzol also, there's a debate Rashi says it means some type of a silk. That they would bring this silk as merchandise for you, they would give.
The English says Vidon, not Andon.
Oh, okay. Okay, I mean it's a place called Vidon. Vidon. The Vav is part of the name. Okay, good. Good, that explains it. So there was some type of a silk that they would bring as merchandise. Barzel asos kidavikane. Ashos kidavikane. Iron. And ashos means like shiny. It was a special type of iron. Kidah v'kaneh. Kidah v'kaneh has different types of spices. The ma'arav echaya, it was as their merchandise it was to you. Didan rochaltech, didan, your merchants, bevigdei chofesh l'richba. With clothing of chofesh, which means very expensive clothing, l'richba for rochev means to ride. And Rashi says it's for the aristocracy, like special clothing to wear. How do they translate Richbo?
Riding.
For riding.
All luxurious clothes.
Okay. Arav v'chol nesiei kedar. Arav, which sounds like Arab, which it is. Mm-hmm. And all nesiei kedar are the princes of Kedar. Hey masochar yadech, they would also do business in your place. Becharim ve'elim batudim bam socharayech, with different types of animals. With sheep and rams and male goats, that's how they were used for business. Rochlei Sheva v'Rama. What about the merchants of Sheva and Rama? Hema rochlei, if they also do business with you, the rosh called bosem, with the best types of spices. Bosem is actually incense, not spices. Best types of incense. Uvachol Evan Yakara, and all the best types of jewels, v'zav and gold, masnu izvonayich, they would give as your merchandise. Charan v'chanei v'ed and rochlei sheva, again, these different places, they would do business, rochlei sheva, they would do business. Ashur kilmad rochal teich. So, these are, again, are places. Is it just listing places? I'm sorry, I got mixed up over here. Just listing places that they would do business with you. Yeah, okay, now the next pasuk tells you what they did. Hema rochlayech b'machlulim. They were your merchants with machlulim, which are things that, these are nice embroideries, different types of materials. Biglome techeles v'rikma uveginze b'romim. B'chavolim, chavushim, v'aruzim, b'marchul teich. So with different types of fancy materials, tcheles, of course, is dyed wool. Also with aruzim is good wood. Very very expensive, strong timber. Anios tarshish sharosayech ma'aravech. The boats of Tarshish, they were, Rashi explains, this means they were your road, Maravech, for your merchandise. See, when you have a city or a country that is land-based, which most countries are, then if you have a nice paved road, then you encourage business. If it's difficult to get to and from the city, that discourages business because people have to fight the roads. So if you're on a virtual island, then you have to make sure that you have not just a good port, but that there are boats to go constantly in and out of the port. So the boats of Tarshish, they were your paved road. It seems like there were boats constantly moving in and out of Tsar, and it was almost like a road. There were so many boats. You could almost walk from one to the other. There was just so much traffic going in and out of Tsar. Vatimol'i, vatichbedi ma'od belev yamim, and you became full, and you became heavy, very heavy, in the middle of the ocean. Here, as we started, Yechezkel compared Tsar to a boat, to a large ocean liner. But the ocean liner became heavier and heavier and heavier. And so as a result, b'mayim rabim heviuch hashatim osach, in great waters, many waters you were brought, those that came to you, the ruach hakadim shivarech belev yamim, and the eastern wind, the strong eastern wind, broke you in the middle of the ocean. Rashi says you have to think of a boat that is becoming more and more laden, and the heavier it is, then when a heavy wind comes, it's easier for it to capsize. Once it's too low in the water, it's too heavy, that's dangerous. When a boat is built to be able to sail, and it has ballast to keep it floating, but it's also not meant to be too heavily laden, because a boat is meant to tip a little bit and then flip back up. That's the whole idea, that the wind can batter it, and the waves can batter it, and it can then flip up afterwards, and it won't capsize. But if it's very, very heavy with merchandise, then once it falls over, it can then flip over in the water. And that's the idea over here, that because it became so laden, therefore it was easy for the wind to knock it over. And that's the analogy for Tsar. There was a joke before D-Day in World War II that Britain, which is where the buildup for D-Day was taking place, so they had literally a million American GIs in Britain, along with all of the tanks and the planes and everything that they needed for that attack. So the joke was that the island was going to sink from all of the weight that was coming in, because it was much more there than there had been ever before. But that's the analogy that Yechezkel wants us to think of over here. Honech, Chavzayin 27. Honech v'izvonayech, your wealth and your merchandise, ma'aravech, another word for merchandise, malachayech, your sailors, the chovlayich, those who use the ropes of the boat, machzike vidkech, those who fix the holes in the boat, v'arve ma'aravech, and those who are involved again in the merchandise, those who take care of the merchandise, v'chol anshei milchamtech, and all those who fight your wars, asher bach that are in you, v'chol kehalech asher b'sochech, and all of your multitudes that are in you, yiplu b'lev yamim, they will fall in the heart of the ocean, in the middle of the ocean, v'yom ma'paltech, on the day that you fall. V'chol za'akas chovloyech yirashu migrishos, to the sound of the crying out of chovloyech, of those who are steering you, those who are pulling the ropes, the migrishos, the scattered villages that are on land, will cry out. They will tremble. The yardu me'aniyos sehem, they will get down from their boats. Kol tov se mashot, all those who are holding on to the oars. Malachim, the sailors. Kol chov lehayam, all those who are dealing with the ropes in the ocean. El ha'aretz ya'amodu, they will go to land. Rashi says, once Tsar is destroyed, then there's no need for the merchants to be at sea anymore. The whole reason why they were at sea was to do business with Tsar. But once Tsar is no longer an economic country, once it's not a place to be, then they all got off their boats and went on land. There was no reason for them to be in the ocean anymore. V'yishmiu alayich b'kolam, and they will make heard about you with their voices. V'yizaku mara, they'll cry out in bitterness. V'yalu afar al rashem, they'll put dirt on their heads. Ba'efer yispalashu, in the ashes they will wallow, they'll roll around. They're going to mourn for the loss of Tsar. V'ikrichu eleich karcha, they will tear their hair out. Literally, yikrichu eleich karcha means they'll make a baldness for you. It was a form of mourning to pull out one's hair. And that's what they would do. The chagru sakim, they're going to wear sackcloth. Uvachu eleich, they're going to cry for you. B'mar nefesh, with bitterness of soul. Mispeid mar, a bitter eulogy. V'nasu eleich b'nihem kina, they will lift up to you with their crying out a lamentation. V'konnu eleich, and they will cry over you. Michitzor, who is like Tsar? Kiduma v'sochayam, who can compare to you inside in the ocean? Who is like Tsar? They're going to say, "B'tzeis izvonayach miyamim." When your merchandise would come out of the oceans, hisbat amim rabim, you would satisfy, you would satiate many nations when you used to have all your wealth. Berov honayachu ma'aravayach, with all of your wealth and your merchandise, ha'ashat malchei aretz, you made kings of the land wealthy. Eis nishberes miyamim b'mamakei moyim, in the time when you are broken in the oceans, in the depths of the water. Ma'aravech v'holkalech b'sochech nafalu, your merchandise and all of your multitudes inside of you, they have fallen. Kol yoshvei ha'iyim shamu alayich, all those who dwell in the islands, they are upset over you, they're desolate over you. Umachehem sar usar, and their kings have called out. So what is sar usar? They've, Rashi says, like a wind. They've been decimated. What does it say over there for sar usar? Anybody?
Seized by trembling.
Okay. Ra'amu panim, and their faces have also trembled. So charim bo'amim sharku aloich, the merchants of the nations, they have like sharku can be like to whistle, but whistle as in like
hiss.
Okay, for you. Balahos hayis, you have been as nothing. Ve'inech adolam, and you are nothing forever. That's the end of the parak. We're not done with Tsar yet, because we have to get to the king of Tsar, which is the beginning of the next parak. But let us examine this parak a little bit more in depth before we go further into Chaf Ches. It wasn't big. It was wealthy and powerful. It wasn't big. As we mentioned last week, it was at certain times it was an island just off the coast, and other times it had a land bridge between the coast and the island, because they had poured dirt to build it up so that it would be able to get this by land. But it was primarily a seafaring nation.
Is this all symbolic? I mean, is it unusual to spend so much time
No, it's not symbolic. This was actually what happened. This is all truth. This is, you know, it obviously has deeper meanings, but it's not just a parable.
And it was mentioning the different countries. It mentions cities, not the countries. Is there a reason for that?
Well, we don't know how consolidated those countries were. I mean, you had, of course, certain ones that were full-fledged countries, and you had different cities that had their own power. So, now, and that were famous for certain merchandise. That's the other thing.
Well, he still had both, because, I mean, even some of the previous Mishalim that he has about the Beit HaMikdash and taking all of them away, both of these things, the Parak and more.
Yeah. We're going to see in the next Parak that the wealth of Tsar corrupted Tsar, and it made the king believe that he was a deity, and that's partially why it was completely destroyed. It got to their heads. We'll also see in the next parak why they deserve to have such wealth in the first place. It's going to have to do, as we've mentioned before, with participating in the building of the first Beis HaMikdash, and we'll see about that as well in the next parak. Now, Tsar has all this wealth. Tsar is a country that has everything. Most of the time, most countries don't have everything. You're not self-sufficient. You have you have to rely on different places for different things. Even if you have a very large countries that have a lot of natural resources, like the United States, but nevertheless, we rely heavily, of course, on foreign oil and other types of imports as well. The different countries have different amounts of their own natural wealth, and then they have to import other things. So most of the time, the way that Hashem has set it up is that countries are not independent. Countries need other countries. You can't survive on your own. That's a reflection of how Hashem made all of us. None of us can survive independently. We yearn for independence. There's always that human urge to be independent of everybody else. I don't want to be beholden to anybody. I want to be able to be completely self-sufficient. There is such a natural urge that a person has. Of course, taken to an extreme, a person wants to be independent from HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself, which is, of course, impossible, logically impossible, but that is the desire for independence. In the United States today, and Western man in general, we have taken that independence to perhaps its highest level ever, and that is something which we value a great deal, to be independent. We celebrate the Day of Independence. We don't want to take care of ourselves. But the reality is it's impossible. Every person is dependent on many, many, many other people. And every country is dependent on other countries. No one can get by. You can try to purchase a plot of land which has farming on it, and it has, and you know, a farm is perhaps the closest thing to self-sufficiency if you're able to take the raw materials and make them into things that are usable. So you can grow your own food, and you can grow your own clothing because of wool, and you can do things like that. But nobody is completely. Maybe you have a natural spring on your property, so the water comes up out of the ground, so you don't need to go to anyplace else for water. But nevertheless, no one is completely independent. You still need other people for whatever things are. If you're a farmer, so you need to go to the doctor sometimes. And if you're, or other types of services that you don't have. Tsar here is the closest thing in the ancient world to being completely independent, because everybody brought them their merchandise. So if everything is in Tsar, then they become a self-sufficient nation. Now, it's not actually self-sufficient because everything's coming from outside.
No, it is most dependent.
Most dependent. That's exactly right. So it's really a facade where everything is there, but they're actually completely dependent on everything else. It's interesting that Tsar is an island. It's in the ocean. Now, the ocean is a place where human beings cannot survive. We can't live in the ocean. We can only live on dry land. We know that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world, so the part of creation where he separated the waters and rolled them back in order to reveal dry land, now was possible for human beings to exist. Without that, you can't have human beings. In the Mabul, when he brought the great flood and Noah was in the Teva, that was the reversal of that step in creation. The dry land was inundated with water, thereby destroying all humans, except for Noah, who was in the Teva. So Tsar exists in a place where people cannot exist. The water surrounding Tsar, it was mentioned before, was a natural defense that attributed to Tsar's power, because it was very difficult to attack Tsar, which Nebuchadnezzar does do, but it was very difficult to do because of its natural barriers. It's very difficult to have a sea attack from the sea when there is no way to get out there from land. In addition, Tsar's location has a, so it's a place which is on the one hand very well protected, but on the other hand, it's unnatural. There's an unnatural sense about Tsar because of where it is. When Hashem destroys Tsar, so after Nebuchadnezzar comes and attacks it and sacks it, then a huge wave drowns Tsar. Tsar is destroyed. So its very defenses end up being its destruction, because the water that surrounds Tsar destroys it. So that is symbolic of the fact that its very wealth is what destroys it. The greatness of Tsar, which is its wealth, is what destroys Tsar. As the analogy says with the boat. The boat, you fill it up and fill it up and fill it up and fill it up, and that ends up being its own destruction. A boat is the most dependent, as Dina said, the most dependent entity there is. If you're on a boat in the middle of the ocean, you have nothing. You don't even have water, because you can't drink the water in the ocean. You have absolutely nothing. You have to take everything with you when you go out into the ocean. So by filling it up and filling it up and filling it up and filling it up, you are giving yourself more and more independence, because you're saying, okay, I have what I need. I'll stock up on what I need. I'll fill up the fridge. I'll fill up the freezer. I'll just keep on filling up. I'll fill up my bank accounts. Everything, I'm just continually taking in and taking in and taking in and taking in, making myself more and more and more independent. But the very thing that is making the boat independent is also making the boat vulnerable to destruction. And in the end, that's what destroys the boat. Because it weighs down the boat and weighs down the boat and weighs down the boat until a wind that otherwise would not have knocked it over now is able to knock it over because of how heavily laden it is. This is the mashal that Hashem is trying to teach us, that wealth is a tremendous bracha. But when a person looks at wealth as a way of becoming independent, if that's the purpose of wealth, because ultimately that's what we want. When you think about what a person wants with wealth, so I just want that. Everybody wants just a little more than they have. I just want to be able to pay my bills. I just want to be able to have a little bit of a cushion in the bank. I just want to be able to go on that vacation. I just want to be able to afford that new car. Whatever the thing is, it's just a little bit more. That's all we want. Every single one of us. Just a little bit more. Why do we want that? Because wealth is empowering. It allows us to do what otherwise we could not do. It allows us a certain degree of independence. But that independence is a facade. That independence itself is the source of destruction. If that's the way we view wealth. If we view wealth as a way of becoming independent of other people and ultimately independent of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which is what Tsar envisioned, then it becomes a self-destructing force. And that's what we're being told over here. We know that wealth is a very big bracha, and it's something that can be used very, 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 very well, and it's a very powerful force in serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And we know that we Jews, our attitude about money is that it's meant to be used to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And we have plenty of examples, both locally and not locally, of Jews who use their wealth properly. But it's always a danger. And that's what's being said over here. I always find it to be so ironic. Before the economic downturn of recent times, but even the very first time I heard this word, I internally laughed. First I was surprised, and internally I laughed about it. But that the term that is used for wealth, for assets, etc., or for where people put their wealth, is securities. That's the term, securities. And it's the greatest oxymoron there is. It's not security in any form or fashion. When a person has wealth, they worry about their wealth. They worry about losing their wealth. And there's nothing that can guarantee wealth. Wealth can be taken away in a second. Wealth can be given in a second. There's no such thing as security, but people think of wealth as security. That's the way people think about it. But it's not actually the case. And that's what we're being shown here with Tsar. Tsar is the example of wealth corrupting and ultimately destroying the very country or the very people that it was protecting.
So why require there have been other countries that don't care about the Shem that have wells and are bad to each other? Why this particular one?
Well, the first question you have to ask yourself is, were they all as wealthy as Tsar?
Different eras.
Yeah, different eras. So this is in this time. I mean, this is, you know, this is the one in the time of Yechezkel. The other thing is that we are systematically going through each country that surrounds Eretz Yisrael at the time of the destruction. We've gone through, as we mentioned in previous weeks, we went through Edom, Ammon, Moab, and Plishtim. Now we're going to go through Tsar, and we're going to go through one more. Sidon is going to be the last one. Once we complete all the countries that surround Eretz Yisrael, we're going to see, not this week, but we will see a summation about how each country around Eretz Yisrael got their share after Eretz Yisrael was destroyed because of their reaction to the Jews' destruction. Tsar was happy because it wanted the wealth of Yerushalayim. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was it a requirement to be on the Sanhedrin to be a wealthy person?
You had to be wealthy to be, I believe so. Yeah, you also had to be wealthy. You had to be wealthy to be the Kohen Gadol.
Right.
You had to be wealthy.
But for everyone, not just the head of the Sanhedrin.
Yeah, I believe so. I don't even remember offhand. I believe that is the case. The reason why that's true is because they had to be above suspicion of bribery. Or, you know, or being beholden to anybody. So they didn't have to be wealthy as in
filthy.
Well, very, very wealthy. But they had to have a certain, they couldn't be people who were struggling.
Certain sense of independence.
Right, exactly. Exactly. They're exactly right. Exactly right. That's right. Now the truth is, even that word independence, if you think about it, that it can also be used in a positive way. The independence from what? What are we trying to be independent of? A person who views their wealth as a gift from HaKadosh Baruch Hu and as a steward themselves, as a steward over that wealth, to use it in the service of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so they don't look at it as being independent from Hashem. Instead, they look at it as being appointed over a job from Hashem. They look at it as, Hashem has given me a particular post in his government, and he wants me to be in charge of this aspect of the treasury. That's the way a person looks at it who looks at it properly. So they don't look at it as independence from Hashem, but it does give that person a certain degree of independence from other people, which evidently is important if you're going to serve the treasury properly. You don't want a treasurer who is dependent on other people, right? We don't want that, because a treasurer who is dependent on other people, what does he do with the money? Right.
He might stick his hand in the pot.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Right. So it goes hand in hand with wealth, is independence. It is a natural consequence, and it's necessary in order to treat the wealth properly. But it's so easy to become corrupted. And that's the warning we're being given over here, how easy it is for one to slip past that line. And how one has to look at it not as a way of getting independent from Hashem, but of just the opposite, of being a faithful steward to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Mm-hmm. That Tsar becomes that example. Now, the king of Tsar, his name is Hiram, or Hiram, and we're about to talk about him. We will talk about him in Perek Chaf Ches, but not the entire Perek. Two-thirds of the parak will deal with him, and then the last third of the parak will be with the country Sidon. Hiram, most Mepharshim say, was also the friend of Yehuda in the story of Yehuda and Tamar. In the story of Yehuda and Tamar, it says that after Yosef was sold by the brothers, it says, Vayered Yehuda me'esechav. Yehuda went down from his brothers. Rashi says, they demoted him. That until that time, Yehuda was looked at as the natural leader. We know the kings come from Yehuda. He was a natural leader. But once he did not stop them from selling Yosef, and in fact, he took an active role in the sale of Yosef, therefore they blamed Yehuda for Yaakov's reaction to the sale, how Yaakov became so despondent after the sale. And he was blamed because he's the leader. The leader always gets the blame, even if other people have done it. But if the leader had the ability to change things and didn't change things, then he gets the blame. So Yehuda was demoted in the eyes of his brother. And the pasuk says, "Vayet ad ish adulami ushmo chira." And then he turned to an Adulamite man, a non-Jew, whose name was Chira, Ches Yod Resh Hey.
What's that? In the Torah, they named him right there in the
Yeah, his name is Chira in the Torah. Ches Yod Resh Hey. Here, the person's name is going to be Chiram, with a mem at the end. But many Mepharshim say it's the same person. And Chira, Yehuda's friend, was he's mentioned several times in that story. In fact, after Yehuda meets with Tamar, then they made a deal that he was supposed to send two goats to Tamar, and he sends the goats with Chira. Chira is the one who takes the goats to Tamar and doesn't find her. She's not there anymore. And he comes back and reports that she's not there anymore, and Yehuda says, okay, fine, so then let her keep the collateral that I gave her, which ends up being the way that Yehuda admits later on that he's the one who lived with her. So that's Chira. Now, later on, because of his being a faithful friend of Yehuda, and because he did not embarrass Yehuda, he didn't give away, he didn't tell anybody that Yehuda was the one who lived with Tamar, he kept his mouth closed. So as a result, Hashem gave Chira two great blessings. One is longevity. And he lived all the way to the time of the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash. Now, if you think about how many years that is, that's a very long time, right? The Beis HaMikdash stood for 410 years, but it was 440 years before it was built. It was 850 years from the time we entered Eretz Yisrael before the Beis HaMikdash was built. Not only that, you have to factor in the wandering in the desert plus the time in Egypt. So Chiram would have been, or Chira, would have been over 1,000 years old. A very long life. So that's one bracha. If we say it's the same man, which many Mepharshim do, that would be one bracha that he got, which is a tremendous longevity. The other bracha that he got was that he had great wealth and great wisdom. Great wisdom. He was a very wise man. He was very, not, I don't mean wise in the sense of like wise beyond their years. I don't mean like that. Wise, I mean, he was smart. He was intelligent. He was able to do a lot of things and create a lot of things that people didn't know how to do.
Why?
So one of the things that he does, and we'll see this later, is, well, he becomes very wealthy. The wealth of Tsar is because of the great wisdom of the king Chiram. He was the brains behind the operation. He ran the business of Tsar. That's who, he was the one who got Tsar to become the great economic power that it was. Later we're going to see that this wealth corrupted Chiram, and he thought himself a deity. And he built for himself, the Gemara says, and it's going to be reported here shortly, he built, we may not get to it this week, but he built for himself some sort of successive platforms that seemed to be suspended in air. Somehow he was able to construct, it wasn't with witchcraft, he was somehow able to construct some type of mechanical thing that enabled his platforms to hover in the air. And he built seven of them as to compare with the seven heavens. You know, we say he was in seventh heaven. That's not just an expression. The Gemara says there are seven Rakim. There are seven heavens. There's the one that we see when we look up in the sky, and there are six more beyond that. So he built seven in order to replicate that of what's real, the real seven heavens. And he set his throne on top of those seven. And as a result, he said, I am like Hashem. I am like God, sitting atop the seven heavens. That's what the wealth did to him. You think it's like, it's incredible. The megalomania, etc. But that's, I mean, he was the most wealthy person. He was the Bill Gates, but he was beyond that. I mean, he had everything.
Not to mention his longevity.
And the longevity, right?
Immortality.
Right, right, immortality. Good.
So Hashem gave all that to him mm-hmm. for his purposes.
But it corrupted him.
Those thousands of years of challenge, my gosh.
But you could look at it differently. You could look at it as, if a person is growing, then if you have 1,000 years to grow, you can be almost an angel at that point. It depends on what you do with your life. That's, you know, that's what...
He removed himself from humanity by being up there.
Well, I don't know if he just stayed there the whole time, but yeah, he certainly projected himself as being a deity, as being above man.
How old was Sarah when she died?
Sarah Bat Asher?
Yeah.
Yeah, she also lived a very long time.
But she didn't get corrupted, she was...
That's correct. She lived into the time of David HaMelech.
Are you talking about S-E-R-A-H?
Yeah.
I thought she lived to eternity.
Yeah, well, it says that she's one of the ones who went into Gan Eden alive, I believe it says. I believe that's what it says. That's not the same thing as saying living for eternity. We don't know what it means to walk into Gan Eden alive. Mm-hmm. But you see, death is the separation of the soul and the body. That's what death is. When we're born, when the soul and body are put together, death, they're separated, and then Tchias HaMeis and resurrection of the dead, they come back together. That's the process. So those who went into Gan Eden in a life, apparently they didn't need the separation of the body and the soul, which is the way Hashem originally created the world. Adam, before he sinned, was supposed to walk into, well, he was in Gan Eden, but he was supposed to walk into the next world, go from this world to the next world without a separation. It wasn't necessary. Because he sinned, that's why we all have to separate and come back together. So those exceptions to the rule, who quote-unquote have beaten the system, and have been able to maintain their connection between body and soul, even while in the next world, it doesn't mean they live forever necessarily. Because they live forever means they're still here. Eliyahu HaNavi, he lives forever. He's still here. Somewhere. He's still around. Now, he also has some kind of an angelic form as well, which we don't fully understand. But he has not gone on to the next world. He's here. But those who went into Gan Eden alive, whatever that means, it doesn't necessarily mean they're living forever.
Mm-hmm. So who besides Sarah?
There's a list. There's a list over there.
He was one of them. One of the 9 people.
Who went into... Right. That's right. He was one of the ones who went into Gan Eden alive. That's what he's listed as.
Who is that?
This man, Hiram. He's listed also as one of those people. Now, the question then is, if a person goes into Gan Eden alive, do they come out again? See, we don't know exactly how it works. Another person who's listed is Eliezer, the slave of Abraham. Right. However, there is another medrash that says that Eliezer is the same person as Og, the giant that Moshe killed. So that according to that medrash, Eliezer was a tzaddik, and then later he became corrupt, and he became an evil man. So the question is, are those two midrashim arguing with each other? Which could be. Could be that they're two different opinions, and they don't agree with each other. One opinion is, he went into Gan Eden alive, and he's still there. The other opinion is, he never went into Gan Eden alive, and he became Og later on. Or can these two be reconciled? Does going into Gan Eden alive preclude coming out of Gan Eden and then going on about their business? I don't know. It's one of those things that I don't fully understand what it means to go into Gan Eden alive. The Gemara has a story of Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi was one of the very late one of the very late Tanaim and the beginning of the Amoraim period, which means that he's one of those transitional figures between the sages of the Mishnah and the sages of the Gemara. And Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi was one of his claims to fame was that he was willing to study Torah with those who were very sick and no one wanted to get near for fear of catching the disease. And Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi said, they have to study also, we can't neglect them. And he was willing to risk becoming ill, and he learned with them. Because he did that, I don't recommend a person getting close to someone who's very sick. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi understood that that was the right thing to do on his level, whatever that means. But because he did this, the Gemara says he became immune to the Malach HaMavis, to the angel of death. And the Gemara relates a whole story how he convinced the Malach HaMavis to take him to Gan Eden, and that he actually went into Gan Eden and then came out again. The Gemara has a story about Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi like that, whatever that means. But I'm just showing you that this idea of going into Gan Eden alive, I don't know that it means they stay there after they go into Gan Eden alive. It could be that they went in and then came out. I just don't know. I know that story in the Gemara. I don't understand that story either. But we may as well just throw into the mix what we don't understand.
So Hiram was so bad that he thought himself a deity.
Yes.
He didn't get into Gan Eden alive.
No, that must have preceded. If they're the same Medrash, if we're going to say that it's the same Medrash, you have to say that it preceded this. That was when he was still righteous. He was righteous in the time of Yehuda, and he was righteous in the time of Shlomo, which is when he helped build the Beit HaMikdash. He provided, as we're going to see later on, he provided material for the construction of the Beit HaMikdash.
Is it one next step? Was he a Jew?
He was not a Jew. He was not a Jew.
And neither was the Abdullah, right?
Neither was?
The one that's with Yehuda.
Yeah, if we are assuming they're the same person, but yeah, right, that's correct.
Converted?
No.
But I don't like hearing about
Elias, or
I want to think that he never did go
there. It could be.
Do we still understand that could be a different
Muslim? Yeah, it could be. I don't know.
He's a beautiful person.
Yeah. There's no question he certainly was at that time. The question only is whether it continued or not. Don't know.
Did Sharon know why he had such wealth and wisdom? Did he know that his son gave it to him?
Apparently he knew at one time. Whether he remembered or didn't remember, that I don't know. But apparently he knew one time. Who mentioned before the longevity itself was a challenge? One of the reasons why, the Medrash says, one of the reasons why, you know, when people were first created, Adam lived to be 930 years old. They routinely lived into the 900s or the 800s. And then after the Mabul, then people's lives started to diminish in length. Noach himself lived to be 950. But after Noach, he was the last of those to live that long. After Noach, they began to diminish in age. So one of the explanations given is because when one lives that long, then they don't deal with their mortality. One of the things that forces us to take life seriously is our mortality. One of the reasons why the 20-year-olds live life with abandon and can do all kinds of things, and then when a person gets into the 30s and 40s, they begin to become more serious. It's not just that they've matured. It's that when a person is in the 30s and 40s, they start to look around and say, one second, life doesn't go on forever. I'm not going to be here forever. They start to see signs of their mortality. Their body doesn't work perfectly anymore. Things start, right? And they start getting signs of, well, you know, will I be able, right? And they start thinking of their future. That's natural. But if a person lives to be 900 years old, and they don't start thinking of their mortality till they're about 632, so then, right, you got 632 years of living like a 25-year-old, or a 22-year-old, or worse. Right.
You can't stay up for 3 nights in a row.
Right.
So why are we talking about Methuselah?
He was a big tzaddik. He was a great tzaddik. He lived to be 969 years old. He's the oldest recorded age in the Torah.
969.
And the Medrash tells us that the flood was delayed 7 days. It was supposed to start 7 days earlier than it did, and it was delayed because he died the day the flood was supposed to start, and Hashem, in deference to his honor, gave 7 days for mourning.
Wow.
For him. It shouldn't be that he was just obliterated and that's it. So he was unbelievable. But so for him the longevity was great. For him, he just continued to serve Hashem. But it's a double-edged sword. Versus, be careful. Okay.